Here, everyone. We just have one more session before lunch. It's the session on cybersecurity and third-party service providers. My colleagues Julio Reed and Katie Clapper are here to join you. One housekeeping note. There was a few questions regarding Wi-Fi. It's just the Marriott public Wi-Fi, if you're able to reach it. There should not be a password for it, but that's the Wi-Fi you could use. So I'll turn it over to Julio and Katie to get things started.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of your busy days. I hope we will have an informative, helpful session on cybersecurity and third-party service providers. So to kick things off, we're going to touch on Interpretive Notices 9070. That's our Information System Security Program Interpretive Notice. This will also touch on Interpretive Notice 9079. That's our third-party service provider interpretive notice, and we want to kind of dig into some of the parallels and the intersection of those two notices. And then I will turn it over to Julio, who will touch on common exam findings, recent cyber threats and breaches and trends, as well as cyber incidents and response. So starting out, cybersecurity. I mean, this isn't really a new topic, and I trust that, you know, most of the people in the audience here are fairly well familiar with cyber threats and the risks that cybersecurity poses to your firms. Although they're ever evolving, it's something that we've been talking about for a while now. And it's certainly something that NFA has been focused on, especially through the interpretive notice I just mentioned. And we've also heard about it a little bit already this morning. However, in the wake of the recent ION cybersecurity event, I think it hits a little closer to home. And we've seen that the damage that a cyber event can have on not only a firm, but also the snowball effect, essentially, that a cyber event can have on the entire industry. So it's something that is, of course, still continues to be top of mind. I think the recent ION event also underscores the need for strong cybersecurity practices, both at the firm level, as well as firms having a robust supervisory framework surrounding the use of third-party service providers for regulatory functions. And of course, as you consider using a third-party service provider for a regulatory function, you also need to think about the cyber risk posed by that third-party service provider. Oops. So as I mentioned, NFA does have two interpretive notices, 9070. This became effective in 2016, so it's been around for a while now. And it sets forth general requirements related to information system security programs and also does address considerations for cyber risk related to third parties. More recently, interpretive notice 9079 went into effect. That became effective in 2021. And it outlines minimum supervisory requirements for using third-party service providers for regulatory functions. And this interpretive notice also touches on information security considerations. So to highlight a few things about the ISSP requirements in that interpretive notice 9070. So this applies to all membership categories across the board. And it requires that members adopt a written ISSP. You can't have it in your head. And it needs to be reviewed annually. We expect that the ISSP is going to be tailored to a firm's business operations, so it's going to be specific to your operations, reviewed annually, as I mentioned. It also has to be approved in writing. This is something that we see sometimes as an oversight. It needs to be approved in writing by the member's CEO or another senior level executive that's responsible primarily for the oversight of information security at a firm. So there's a few key elements that I'll touch on. The first is a risk assessment. So we would expect a member to undergo a risk assessment of its cyber threats and vulnerabilities. As part of this risk assessment, firms need to consider critical hardware with network connectivity, data transmission or storage points, and critical software along with the versions that are in use. Firms also have to think about significant internal and external threats. So threats to data. So this may be customer PII, counterparty PII. It may be your own personal confidential sensitive information. And it also, firms need to think about, as I mentioned, the cyber risks that are being posed by third-party service providers. So as part of your risk assessment, obviously there's the internal threats, there's external, but you really have to think about cyber threats that are going to be posed to you by your third-party service providers. Also, firms need to consider risks that they've learned, right? So from past incidents at the firm, past incidents at your third parties, or even industry-wide, because as we know and have seen, the risks are kind of ever-evolving in the cybersecurity space. So what do you do with the risk assessment? Well, you need to document safeguards. How are you going to mitigate these threats? So you've identified them, and now you need to consider what steps you're going to take to try to prevent an issue from happening. Some examples: complex passwords, having access controls to system and data, make sure you're using updated software, and of course, backing up systems and data. And I think, not to get too far ahead, but these are questions that you should probably consider asking of your critical third-party service providers too. Okay. So also highlight next interpretive notice 9079. So this is the more recent third-party service provider interpretive notice. And again, this interpretive notice applies to all members. Similar to ISSP, you need a written documentation or a written document highlighting how you're going to go about supervising your third-party service providers who perform a regulatory function. I want to make that clear. So this interpretive notice applies to third-party service providers where you're outsourcing a regulatory function. So a key element of this is going to be, again, to do a risk assessment. What are the information security risks that are going to be posed by that third-party service provider? Firms need to start considering this. As part of the written supervisory framework to back up, you want to do a risk assessment overall. Is a firm comfortable mitigating the risks of outsourcing a regulatory function to a third party? What happens if there's an outage? So a firm wants to consider, again, security risks, regulatory risks, and just logistical considerations. Can this third party actually perform the service that you're trying to have them do for you? The next step that would be expected would be initial onboarding. So if you've decided you can outsource a function, you're comfortable that you can mitigate it, what kind of initial due diligence are you going to do when you bring a vendor on? And then it doesn't stop there. You have to have some kind of ongoing monitoring of the third party to make sure, again, that they can carry out the function. And I think it's important to point out that the level of due diligence, I think both initial and ongoing, should correspond to the criticality of that vendor and the regulatory function that they're providing you. So we would expect a level of heightened scrutiny if it's a critical vendor. Firms also need to consider termination. So if you're going to terminate the agreement with the third party, you have to make sure that contractually the third party has to give you adequate termination notice. They can't just pull the rug out from under you and leave you unable to perform a regulatory function. And you also need to consider what information the third party has access to. So when the relationship's terminated, you want to make sure that there's no more sensitive data or information being held with that third party. And finally, there's a record-keeping element to this interpretive notice. So you need to maintain records that demonstrate that you're going through these steps and you're meeting the requirements under the supervisory framework. Okay, so how do these two interpretive notices intersect? So in both, we talked about a risk assessment. So when you're using a third party to do a regulatory function for you, you're going to do the risk assessment, but you really need to consider the information security risks that are posed. What information and data does that third party have access to? What could they potentially do with it if there's a cyber attack? What are the legal and regulatory risks associated with outsourcing to that third party? So if the third party fails and you can't complete your regulatory responsibilities, NFA will look to you. You're the member, and you need to uphold your regulatory responsibilities even if you're outsourcing that regulatory function. So I think it's very important that firms think about a backup plan, whether it's another service provider, maybe it's another broker, maybe it's a manual process in place in-house. I mean, I think folks just need to go through the thought process to figure out, if they crash and they can't do what they're doing, how am I going to step in to reasonably meet my regulatory expectations? On the due diligence, again, and I mentioned this before, but we would expect heightened scrutiny if you're outsourcing a very critical regulatory function. So really taking a hard look at the IT practices of the third party. Do they have good cybersecurity hygiene? Do they have a history of events? Are they transparent about their business continuity and disaster recovery planning? So if there is an issue, you're comfortable that they at least have a process in place to get back up and running. Are they telling you how fast? What are the expectations? Are they backing up data? So you can see there's kind of a lot of different things to think about, but I think these are very important conversations to have. Firms also need to really consider if they're becoming overly reliant or dependent on a particular third party. And again, I think that comes back to the contingency plan and the backup. It just becomes harder to have a contingency plan if you're very reliant on one particular vendor. And finally, I wanted to touch on written agreements. So under Interpretive Notice 9079 for third-party service providers, you are required to have a written agreement anytime you're going to outsource a regulatory function. These SLAs or service level agreements, of course, would define the scope of service and performance expectations. But I think it's also important to think about escalation and perhaps, depending again on the service being provided, consider whether cyber expectations should be outlined in these agreements. Consider whether you should outline escalation, how a cyber breach or event is communicated to you as the firm. So I guess in summary, I think it's safe to say that the recent ION events highlighted the need to critically evaluate cybersecurity risks, not only at the firm level, but also the practices by third-party service providers, both at onboarding and throughout the course of the relationship. And the events also really emphasize the need to have a contingency plan in place and do some kind of planning to make sure you can reasonably meet regulatory obligations in the event there is a critical third-party service provider outage. And now I'll turn it over to Julio to talk about exam observations.
Thank you, Katie. So in regards to our exams observations in which we have conducted our examinations, we found a number of consistent areas where there's a level of deficiency in some of the examinations related to cybersecurity. So the first is lack of documented ISSP findings. This is something that I'm sure a number of colleagues from the previous session have actually referenced in regards to having an established documented ISSP plan. We've actually done examinations where we've actually had the firm actually narrate the ISSP plan to us. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking for something that is documented that actually shows an outline of what you need to do in regards to an incident response plan, what you are doing in regards to cybersecurity training, what you are doing in regards to password management. We look for something where it is documented and up to date and is able to be referenced, updated accordingly in reference to any kind of material changes. In regards to approving writing, we look for something that actually has to be acknowledged by the CEO or the designated AP of that firm. Oftentimes, we will receive an email from the firm saying, here's an ISSP plan. It's like, okay, has your CEO looked at this? Well, no, he hasn't. It's still in draft. So we look for something that actually has been acknowledged. And by acknowledged, it's no longer in draft. The CEO has actually reviewed it and confirmed that it has all the elements that needs to be entered in there. Performance, security, and risk analysis. This is also a common area that we see in the deficiency in regards to our examinations. In regards to performing a security risk analysis, we look for the firm to step back and say, okay, what are the key critical areas within the firm that might require additional security controls. In applying data loss protection measures, it goes hand in hand. When you take a step back and you look at certain areas that contains critical information, you will undoubtedly want to consider implementing additional security other than just your regular desktop logon and accessing that information. We look for a firm to have some form of a structured process in place where they can actually identify those particular critical areas and that they actually have some level of additional safeguard that is applied to those critical areas. Non-enforced cyber training. From my point of view, as the cybersecurity compliance manager at NFA, this is the one key area that I always lean on in regards to the firms and members. it is imperative that you actually train your staff and all staff, not just the senior personnel or the support personnel, all staff, particularly anyone who has access to email in cybersecurity training. The training should be somewhat structured and have references to examples of what to look for in regards to, say, for instance, a phishing attack, or if someone is impersonating somebody that you affiliate with or that you send wires to, how to define and look for certain key elements within those emails to see that this isn't a valid email. Training helps with this. Training gives an insight to identify certain areas, and training also gives an insight in regards to who to contact if you see something that doesn't seem right. So this is the one key area that I'm always leaning on a lot of firms in regards to making sure you train your staff, because the key critical vulnerability in any firm is everyone in here, human personnel. Limited third-party assessments performed. As Katie has referenced, third-party assessment is becoming a more common threat more and more in each year. A number of firms are outsourcing a lot of their third-party activities to third-party providers, which is understandable. They might not have the internal subject matter expertise there, so they will outsource it to a third party who has that level of expertise. We look for the firm to establish a level of communication with that firm in making sure that, A, they're not just performing in performing the requirements as outlined within the contract agreements, but also that the firm is doing some level of due diligence on their part to making sure that they're protecting your data on your behalf. Ad hoc incident response plan. There's been a number of firms where they actually had an incident and they actually reported to us, and I'll go into a lot more detail on that in further slides. But having a incident response plan helps prevent you from doing any kind of knee-jerk reaction to try to remediate any kind of incident that comes up. The phrase location, location, or I know just enough to be dangerous comes to mind when a lot of people doesn't have an incident response plan. They will probably try to do the investigation themselves, try to backtrace where the threat came from, and this can cause further damage to your environment from a cyber perspective. Having an incident response plan means that you have a plan in place to reach out to certain subject matter expertise personnel and incorporate certain individual where needed, including contacting regulators where needed. Safeguarding information. These lists include some of the common safeguards that we found to be across the board, not just from an industry perspective, but from working with some of our members and working with other firms. Data loss prevention rules, making sure consistent system monitoring is being performed. Block outbound emails with PII. Again, phishing is always something that's a common threat in any firm, and it's something that requires continuous monitoring as well as continuous support. Authentication, implementing zero trust. By zero trust, this basically means that normally you will log into your desktop and access all your applications. However, with zero trust, you might be required to authenticate into a particular application that requires you to pull additional information down to do further processing, or that you might need to log into a database environment to access information that is stored, or that you might need to access some form of marketing information that contains critical information that stores all that area that you need to pull down from. Those areas might require an additional authentication in addition to your desktop logon. That is pretty much a high-level definition of zero trust, where nothing is taken for granted. Everything requires your authentication into the environment. Multi-factor authentication. Multi-factor authentication is becoming more and more popular, not just with the firms, but also from an industry standpoint. We look for our members to incorporate multi-factor authentication, particularly where critical information exists. We don't encourage that multi-factor be applied across the board to non-critical information, But we look for the firms to actually do a security risk analysis to identify those critical areas and apply multi-factor or two-factor authentication where needed. I'm sure all of us know when we log in into our banking accounts, it requires you to do an additional authentication. You'll probably receive a code, or you might require to click on certain boxes to identify certain elements, or it might require you to recall certain information that you might know. I mean, I only know my grandma's maiden name. I'm sure no one else knows that. So that's something that's becoming more and more common. Those kind of multi-factor authentications is something that you should consider incorporating, particularly for your critical information. Protecting PII, encryption when sharing critical information. This is becoming a de facto from the industry standpoint. Most technologies out there actually has their inherent encryption capabilities therein, because they know that this is something where if you're sharing information with a third party or an affiliate or with a customer, that pipeline where you're sharing that information needs to be encrypted, especially if there's critical information being transposed back and forth from that location. We've actually found that a number of firms actually are not enacting this particular criteria that's inherent within their software, and we're not sure why, but in educating them in regards to like applying certain additional security controls, critical information, a lot of more and more of considering incorporating it and actually reaching out to third parties to ask for advice in regards to how to further apply maybe even additional third-party level encryption. Sharing documents through secure portals, VPNs. This is also a key area that is becoming more and more popular, particularly with cloud technology. By VPN, you're logging into an environment that requires you to authenticate into an environment that only you can access. And it exists out in the internet, but it is an area that only you can access and only you can manipulate the data within there. We're seeing more and more of our firms going into this direction, which is ideal. And it's something that is gaining momentum, particularly more from a cloud technology standpoint. Cyber industry threats and breaches. So from an industry standpoint, we're seeing these particular threats that are gaining momentum. Phishing attack, obviously, that's the first. Phishing attacks, unfortunately, is not going away. It is gaining momentum by means and bounds, particularly in firms that actually do a lot of business processing via the internet. So oftentimes, certain firms are actually communicating with other third parties or other affiliates or other customers, and they're doing a large amount, a large volume of processing on the internet. And sometimes they receive an email and they click on it and they might not read it thoroughly. So phishing attack is something that is gaining momentum. The best recourse of action against phishing activities is training to identify what are invalid emails and what are valid emails. Phishing is also gaining momentum. Phishing is basically phishing, but via voicemail or voice calls. I'm sure a lot have heard that artificial intelligence, that you can actually create a voice message that actually sounds like your manager. And they can send this to you where you think the manager is stating, hey, send a wire transaction of over $200,000 to this account. Don't send it to this other account. Send it to this other account. And it sounds just like your manager, but it is not your manager. So this is where training comes in. You actually would need to go in and actually call your manager and say, hey, did you send me an email, a voicemail in regards to this? No, I didn't. So need to be somewhat wary of certain voice messages that are being left that might seem legitimate or that might require you to work really quickly to send any kind of wire transmission. Smishing is basically text messages. This is also gaining momentum where you'll probably receive something from your bank stating a fraudulent activity was made to your accounts from such and such bank. Please click on this link to validate that this is something that you did not execute or that you did not give permission to. And clicking on that link might download some kind of fraudulent malicious software. So be wary of that. Contact the bank directly, or contact your affiliates correctly, or contact any person or third party that you work with and transpose any critical information. Spear phishing is basically when the phishing attack is tailored specifically towards a certain group or certain personnel within the organization. So there's been a number of spear phishing attacks that's been targeted towards the accounts payable area of a number of firms. And again, they're combining multiple attack fronts where they're using phishing and they're using wire transmission, and then they were followed up with some kind of fraudulent email. So they're trying to combine a lot of attack approaches to see where the vulnerability exists. So be wary of certain attacks that where it's only being tailored towards the, like the accounting department or the finance department or any area within the firm that manages the firm's finances. Whaling attacks. Basically, whaling attacks is basically any kind of attacks, whether it's phishing, vishing, or smishing attack, that is targeted towards the senior personnel of the firm, such as the CEO, chief technology officer, chief operations officer, or even the chief communications officer. Anyone who is at that level where they feel that they actually have access to multiple environments because of their level within the firm. There's a lot of attacks we're seeing in regards to those. Ransomware, not much to say. It exists. It's growing. It's also not going away. And it is gaining momentum by leaps and bounds, particularly with a lot of firms who are actually doing their businesses on the internet. So it's something that we recognize that a lot of firms still somewhat struggle with, but having multiple layers in place, such as a system policy, such as training your staff personnel, such as making sure that you're doing appropriate monitoring. Ransomware can be either limited or eliminated entirely by having multiple filters in place where if the attacker tries to go past one, the second filter is more stringent than the former. So having those kind of filters in place helps. Distributed denial of services. I'll discuss this particular attack more in detail, but distributed denial of services basically is an attack where there are a number of requests that's made to the firm's website. Say, for instance, if a firm is requesting to create a new application, so consider if that one person is multiplied by 100 or 1,000, and it's executed by an attacker who's sitting somewhere with multiple laptops, and he's executing all these requests all at once. This can pretty much cripple or even bring down the firm's servers instantly. This causes a disruption in services, which obviously causes disruption in the business operations, which obviously causes some loss in funds for the day or maybe a couple of days. Making sure that there's appropriate monitoring in place where you see an uptick of certain type of requests of this nature should be in place where it's intercepted immediately. User account password attacks. Those have been around ever since user accounts and passwords have been created. They are becoming a lot more sophisticated where certain personnel are using social engineering where they're contacting staff members or they're contacting third-party affiliates and pretending to be somebody related from your firm or somebody on behalf of your firm, requesting information or access to certain critical areas. Again, this is where training comes in, where you will send up a red flag and identifying that this doesn't seem something that's valid and that you might want to question activities related to that. Third-party attacks. Third-party attacks are becoming more prevalent, obviously, because of a lot of third-party contractual relationships that most firms are now gearing towards. We're seeing a tremendous uptick in cloud technology attacks as well. And cloud technology, by definition, is when you basically a third party is managing a infrastructure and technology infrastructure, and it can either store or process or transpose information on behalf of the firm. So a number of attackers are trying to go after a lot of these third parties because once you gain access to this virtual environment, you pretty much got access to a number of other businesses and firms' environments as well. Make sure that your firm actually reach out to the third parties and that the third parties have appropriate security controls and safeguards in place for certain activities and certain attacks of this nature. So just want to touch bases on what's going on. Even though, you know, some of our members are being attacked, there are attacks happening in the industry wide, all everywhere. So in regards to the IANA attack, which Katie had referenced earlier, it had started off on the 1st of January, and it was related to a third-party vulnerability. And its systems were compromised from that third party, and the third party was hacked on behalf of a number of the firms. The attacker was not intentionally meant to attack the third party. The attacker meant to intentionally attack the third party to gain access to a lot of firms and some of the members here. Although it was an attack that was it was an attack that was a common attack, it was something that was actually stopped by the third party. And the attack was by, I believe, a Russian group called Lockbit, which is a very sophisticated Russian group that attacks a number of different firms. Incidentally, it was a ransom attack where they were able to go in, snatch data, pull, and exit out within a certain amount of time fairly quickly. And the third party was able to like lock everything down, isolate the area that was attacked so it would not cause any further damage. This kind of attack happens frequently, and make sure that your third party have security controls in place, again, is evident to be something that should be considered. The Robinhood attack basically is a DDoS attack where an attacker gained access to login credentials for the network environment. This is something where we've seen in the past from some of our firms that reached out to us and gave us information about they were breached. This is an attack that it was a spear phishing attack. However, you know, it was something that could have been stopped and avoided. They reached out. Someone called one of the staff members, reached out to them and asked them, told them that I'm a member of the support team, Microsoft, if you could give me access to this information, I can provide an update to you guys' software, including Word, PowerPoint, Excel. And the staff member obliged, gave them user ID and credentials. Perfect. Now they're in. So this attack actually was something where they were able to, the attacker was able to take, run away with over 100,000 in cryptocurrency. And the firm actually had to pay a ransom of that. Although the firm was a little hesitant at first, the attacker published some of the data out in the black, on the dark web, and suddenly the attacker received a check from the firm stating, hey, take it down. The New Zealand Stock Exchange website was a DDoS attack where they actually meant someone meant to bring down the firm. It wasn't something where they needed to gain any kind of financial gain. It was more of an attack where an attacker wanted to prove this, their person's prowess in being able to bring down an exchange, and they were able to do it successfully. FTX cryptocurrency. Has anyone not heard of the FTX cryptocurrency attack? Sam Bankman-Fried. This isn't actually a cybersecurity breach initially. However, because it was a result of lack of liquidity and management of funds, while they were conducting investigations from that, attackers were actually able to break in and withdrew somewhere around $600 million from customer wallets. I had listed this attack on there to bring a particular point. Most of the time, whenever firms are going through any kind of distress or challenges or financial hardships, and it is something that has gained mainstream media attention, attackers will use this opportunity to come in through the back door. and they saw this as an opportunity where they're like busy over here and let's just go in through this way. And that was how they was able to successfully gain access and steal $600 million worth from customer wallets. So during certain challenges area, particularly when you hear about certain firms that are in mainstream and going through certain challenges from an operational standpoint, it's ideal to make sure that support teams of that firm is actually monitoring activity from a cybersecurity standpoint, because attackers use this opportunity to try to up their ability to access the environment. The Flagstar Bank, over 1.3 million customer data have been breached, including Social Security numbers. I had listed this on here because although Flagstar had in their policy stating that they do encrypt critical information, it turns out that they did not. And the attackers were able to access and gain access to customers' data, including date of birth, name, Social Security number, and a slew of other critical information. So it's one thing to state in your ISSP policy that this is done. It's another thing to actually making sure it's being done. So lessons learned from best practices. So ongoing training and awareness is something that's needed. Simulated phishing exercises, as I referenced. Multi-factor authentication, third-party risk management for cloud providers, security and event monitoring, and data loss prevention safeguards. Everything I've stated earlier, these are the best lessons learned to walk away with. So in regards to cyber incidents, we receive a number of incidents internally in regards to ransomware, social engineering, compromised emails, phishing attack, third-party, and DDoS attacks. Basically, some of the safeguards that I referenced should be applied, have been applied from some of our members who actually reached out to us and told us about these particular breaches. No one is pretty much exempt from certain breaches of this nature, but making sure the attacker works twice as hard to get in there helps. So responding to a cyber incident, I'm not going to go through each one of these in details. You know, execute our response plans, consider hiring a third-party investigator, notify regulators, and by notifying regulators, if it is a breach and it is defined as a breach, please notify us, and we will work with you accordingly and conduct investigation, and we can also even provide some level of advice how to further fortify your environment, as well as reach out to law enforcement and information sharing agencies. So as I stated earlier, notify bank funds are involved, notify insurance company and file suspicious report if it fits under the SAR, if appropriate, and update the ISSP to incorporate lessons learned if this is something that is considered of a material incident that should be updated within your ISSP, by all means, make sure it's implemented in there. And finally, cyber incidents in regards to notifying NFA. Any loss of customer counterparty funds, any loss of members' own capital, as well as member providing notice to customers' counterparties under state or federal law. Any one of these requires you to notify NFA, or it can be a combination of one or two of these that would require you to notify NFA. And I'll take any questions.
Hi, my question is, as a way to rebel against some of these cyber attacks, there are some of these professionals that I see online that partake in what's called scam baiting, where they basically, these hackers, they'll come in and these people will go in, and as to rebel, they'll be able to track down the location of where these scammers are and actually shut them down and get the FBI involved and basically shut down their operations. So does the NFA support this type of behavior or plan to work with some of these professionals that are really taking the action to stop these scammers from ever doing this type of behavior ever again?
Well, as we have referenced earlier, NFA doesn't actually endorse any consultant firm or any products to be used. From our observations from examinations, we found that a number of firms are more comfortable working with more established vendors that actually has a strong history of, you know, doing that level of work. You'll find that there's a lot of third parties out there who are actually certified in specific areas that are better equipped to work with. That way they actually can provide backing and some level of guarantee in relation to that.
Hi there. A question on ransomware in particular. Mm-hmm. Over here.
Oh,
hi.
Sorry.
Hi there. Speaking to you from the corner. So it was interesting referencing ransomware and particularly some firms that the NFA may have worked with or at least supervised and who paid ransomware. And I wonder, A, is that something that the NFA would expect firms would do? Is there provisions within sort of CFTC guidance that that is something a firm would do? When you think of it in the broader perspective, it would be difficult to do that and then also meet your requirements with respect to financial crime, AML, et cetera, et cetera. So just any insights you could provide there are interesting.
Well, as far as ransomware, you know, most of the regulatory agencies as a whole do not encourage paying the ransom. This further encourages the attackers to consider providing other attacks on ransomware activities. Most firms and most of our members do consider paying it in hopes of trying to eliminate the limelight that is being shown on them that there has been a breach of this nature. And they want to put it in their past fairly quickly. As far as whether it's a, in regards to dealing with AML, it's something that I will recommend you work with your chief compliance officer internally to see what are the steps in regards to related to that that needs to be taken in regards to that particular area.
I think the AML point's a good one, and I think, you know, I know Julio mentioned the incident response plan, and I think it would be probably prudent to consider some of those steps, like referring to your AML officer, your chief compliance officer, in the incident, in the event that there's a cyber or ransomware attack, just so that's when you're going through the steps, not overlooked, because I can see in an event like that, it may be something that is overlooked. So to make sure that those kind of regulatory notifications and AML considerations are considered.
Does the NFA have any plans to implement multi-factor authentication for logging into the online registration system or electronic filing system?
Sure. So yes. So because we are delegated certain activities from the CFTC and it is a requirement of theirs, that is something that we're working towards for certain member-facing applications. And yes, and we will definitely keep everyone updated and educated when that's coming so there's ample notice.
In terms of the written approval of the ISSP, you had mentioned that the CEO needs to sign off on that. Can that be expanded to another officer of the firm that has expertise in cybersecurity?
Sure, yes. So I think it's any senior level person that's primarily responsible for oversight would be also appropriate.
Great, thanks. My understanding as well.
I think that we have time just for one more question.
Those situations where a member firm reported to the NFA that there's been a breach, mm-hmm. has the NFA informed members they were doing business with of the breach or anything? I know it's a responsibility of another firm to tell counterparties and so forth that there's been a breach. But historically, it's known that a lot of firms are reluctant to do so. So what happens from that point on? In other words, could I be doing business with a member firm that has a breach but unaware is what is my question.
Right. So NFA would not notify the other member. I think that's something that should certainly be considered in your service level agreements when you're doing business and setting up relationships with other members of that they would be required to notify you of a breach.
But that is an exposure that a member firm may have, though, right? Even though you have an agreement in place, there's a chance that the member firm is not going to be informed by the NFA or the other member firm.
Yeah. Sure.
Thank you for that. I know we're right at lunch, so we'll break for lunch. If you have any additional questions, though, I encourage you to go up to Katie Julio or any of the other NFA staff while you're at lunch. And again, you could always reach out to NFA's information center. The contact information is on NFA's website if you have any information. So we'll take a 1 hour break for lunch. Lunch is just served right outside, and you're welcome to bring your plates back here and enjoy.